From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm David Bianculli, in for Terry Gross. The popular and award-winning cop drama The Shield just began season 6. On today's Fresh Air, we feature interviews with creator and writer Sean Ryan and with CCH Pounder, who plays former detective Claudette Wims, who has just been promoted to captain. And film critic David Edelstein reviews Hot Fuzz, the spoof of Hollywood action films by the makers of Shaun of the Dead. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bianculli, TV critic for the New York Daily News, sitting in for Terry Gross. The Shield, starring Michael Chiklis as Detective Vic Mackey, is the series that put the FX cable network on the map. The Sopranos had shot HBO to a new level by presenting a drama series where the central character was a cold-blooded killer. The Shield took the same approach, but with an even more sinister twist. Its cold-blooded killer was a cop, not a mobster. And in the pilot episode, he got away with murder. Murdering, in fact, one of his own. But Sean Ryan, creator of The Shield, hasn't let that storyline die. All last season, and in the first episodes this year, The Shield has had Vic investigated by an internal affairs officer named Kavanaugh, played by recent Oscar winner Forrest Whitaker. Kavanaugh is sure Mackey has committed 2 murders. And even though Kavanaugh is right about only one, that gives their face-to-face confrontations an extra jolt. Who exactly is the good guy here?
You think I'm a cop killer? Maybe I am. You're a cop, right?
That sounds like a direct threat of my life, detective. What that means?
It means you just stepped onto an entirely new playing field. For your sake, I hope you know the rules of the game.
Today on Fresh Air, we'll salute this long-running, still intense drama series by visiting with Sean Ryan, creator of The Shield, and with actress CCH Pounder, who plays Captain Claudette Wims. We'll start with Sean Ryan. In addition to The Shield, Ryan is represented on TV right now by the CBS action series The Unit, with co-executive producer David Mamet. But years ago, Ryan wrote for a very different type of action show, Nash Bridges, the detective series starring Don Johnson. Terry Gross spoke to Sean Ryan last year, and he told her that Nash Bridges was more of an entertainment show than a realistic depiction of police work.
That was very much a hero show. So Don Johnson's character, Nash, really couldn't screw up very badly. He always had to have the right intentions, so if something went bad, it wasn't because any human foible of his caused it to go bad. And the shows ended happily. The crimes were always solved, and he was a straight up hero. And if there was any problem with Nash, it was that he just couldn't quite make whatever his current relationship with a beautiful woman quite work out because he couldn't commit. That, that was like the one big character flaw, quote unquote. It was a very successful show. It ran for 6 years, and that's the way that show needed to be for what it was. There was a hierarchy that, Nash was the one that needed to solve the crimes. He was the one that needed to swoop in at the last second. One of his underlings was never the one that, was the hero of the day and would save it. So it was those kinds of things, and especially the intentions. These were cops to look up to, and they always had everyone's, they always had the innocent public's best interests at heart.
Okay, now you can't say that happens in The Shield. I mean, some of the cops at the center of The Shield, particularly the star of the show, the character played by Michael Chiklis, I mean, he's not only corrupt, he's kind of sadistic. He really enjoys violence.
He has a few flaws. you know, I wanted to write in the gray areas. You know, I'd written a very black and white show for 3 years and been successful doing it, and the show was successful, and it was my job to, you know, to service my bosses and presenting them with the material that they wanted, and I worked hard to do that. There were just a lot of sacred cows. You know, for instance, on almost every TV cop show I'd seen in the 90s or in the late 80s, the heroes would be like the detectives, and the boss, the captain, would be a minority. And it was television's way of saying, you know, well, we acknowledge that it's a multi-ethnic universe, but we're not going to sort of put them forefront. And additionally, our minority captain is going to be above reproach and, you know, isn't going to have a bad quality at all. I looked at Edward James Olmos' character in Miami Vice. I looked at James McDaniel's character in NYPD Blue, Yaphet Kotto's character in Homicide. All these shows sort of had this thing. And so my first thing was, well, you know what? I'm going to have a minority captain, but everyone's going to hate him. and everyone's going to think that he's a quota baby that got the job, you know, because of his race, not because of his talent. And not everyone's going to look up to him.
You know, you're talking about trying to break the rules of some of the shows that you really admired. Now, in shows like Homicide and Law and Order, there's some like fabulous interrogation scenes, and you really admire how well these cops, how brilliant some of these cops are at interrogating. In the pilot, and excuse me for going all the way back to the pilot, but, you know, although I've been watching the series for some time, I never saw the pilot until last night on DVD. So it's really a brilliant episode. It's like maybe the best pilot I've ever seen. But anyways, there's three separate interrogation scenes in that, and each of them are really different. Each of them serves a different dramatic purpose and reveals something different about the person doing the interrogating. Would you just talk about how you used each of those interrogation scenes to do a whole lot of dramatic work?
Yeah, Homicide, like I said, Homicide really was my favorite show, and I was always impressed with their interrogation scenes, especially the ones involving Andre Brower's character. And really what I took from that show was that interrogation scenes in good dramas are about the detectives. They're not about finding out the truth of a case. They're not about just furthering plot. So I wanted to find out, you know, Dutch has a few scenes with this pedophile where he just goes along and sort of shows empathy for, you know, for how you can be attracted to young girls. And it showed the sort of gamesmanship and mindset that he was willing to get into to break this guy. And then we had, you know, a very sort of infamous scene with Vic Mackey, and another pedophile kidnapper near the end, and we saw just sort of how ruthless he could be. But those scenes were designed to get into the characters of our detectives and find out who they are, which are far more interesting interrogation scenes than just browbeating people until they tell you that they did it.
Well, yeah, and you know, Dutch, the cop who's interrogating the child molester, the first time he really gets into the guy's head, and he's basically saying, say, do you believe there's a gay gene? Do you believe that, like, people are born gay? Well, if people are born gay, maybe people are born to be child molesters, too. I mean, I understand what you're going through, and that's very effective. But then he does it again on another child molester, and the child molester's attitude is like, hey, I know the game you're playing, and it's not going to work on me. I'm smart, too.
Yeah.
And then the third time, like Vic Mackey, the Michael Chiklis character, goes in and just like beats the confession out of him. And the contrast between those three interrogation scenes is so interesting dramatically and in what they reveal about each of the characters.
Yeah, there's a time for each of them, I think. And you know, what I was really trying to get at is that, yes, it is tempting to resort to brute behavior at times, and sometimes it can be even effective, but is that what we want? And I never really try to take sides and sort of, you know, pick a side. But I wanted, knowing that at the end of the episode I was going to have Vic kill Terry, it's really
and just,
completely
just to say who Terry is, for our listeners who haven't been following the story, Terry is somebody from Internal Affairs who was investigating whether these cops are on the take or not, whether they
he
were
was
corrupt.
On Vic's team and was actually trying to work undercover to take Vic and his buddies down. And what I wanted through the other story, through the interrogation with pedophile, is to see how it's tempting to give law enforcement people sort of unlimited power to do anything to solve these heinous crimes, because there's a slippery slope at the end of it. Because when you give them power to act on your behalf, don't be surprised when they take that power to act on their own behalf.
Sean Ryan, creator of The Shield, speaking to Terry Gross in 2006. The show is in its sixth season now, coming off years in which Forrest Whitaker and Glenn Close, respectively, joined the ranks for season-long guest appearances. Here's the interrogation scene Sean Ryan and Terry were just discussing. Jay Carnes plays the detective named Dutch.
Here's your coffee.
When are you going to call about my mom's pills?
In a minute.
I got nothing to hide.
I know. Hey, tell me something. Think there's something wrong with gay people?
Something wrong?
In the head, you know, with queers. I mean, you think they got a screw loose?
I don't know.
Not so long ago, medical community classified homosexuality as a disorder, called it an illness.
Yeah.
Now scientists think maybe it's something genetic makes people gay.
So?
For booking. So, if God made them that way, who are we to say they're wrong for doing the things they do? It got me thinking. What if scientists discover there's a gene that predisposes some people to be attracted to young girls?
You think there is, in some people?
Well, why not? And if scientists discover that gene, then maybe people won't think it's so wrong to have sex with underage girls.
Maybe not.
Forgot to call about your mom's pills.
When the pilot was accepted by FX, this was before Nip Tuck, it was before Dennis Leary's series was on the air, Rescue Me. And people weren't thinking, oh, FX, that's the real, like, happening network now for new shows. So was it hard to convince actors that it was a good idea for them to get started in an FX series?
Oh, absolutely. I can't, you know, there were actors that I had never heard of who refused to come in and read for the role of Vic Mackey, in all seriousness. And I was like, or it was an offer only. If you want to offer me the role, maybe I'll consider doing it. And I'm like, well, who is this person again? Have I even seen him in anything? I mean, who? And I know for a fact that there were agents who were steering actors away from doing this. I know that there was an actor that we were seriously considering for the character of Shane, who I know through back channel things that his agent essentially convinced him, you know, it's not worth doing a show on this network. And so that person never sort of came in for final consideration, you know, for the role. It was difficult, but in the end, it turned out to be a blessing, because what happened was that we only got people on the show who desperately wanted to do the show. And there was an excitement and energy that I think really translated to the screen because of that.
Sean Ryan, speaking with Terry Gross last year. His series, The Shield, is now in its sixth season on the FX cable network. Coming up, one of the stars of that show, CCH Pounder. This is Fresh Air. The character of Claudette Wims began on The Shield as a detective, just one of many working in the squad room at one of the bullpen desks. But after many long years and frustrating delays, she's finally been promoted to captain. A testament not only to her talents, but to those of the actress playing her, CCH Pounder. Terry spoke with Pounder last year. Both the character and the actress make quite an impact in this scene, in which Wims is interrogating a suspect with a horrible scar on his face. She doesn't know that the person who gave him the scar is Detective Vic Mackey.
You've got a lot on your plate. Where'd you find the time? Drug trafficking. Consolidating a Mexican power base. Murder. Am I leaving anything out? Oh, yeah. juvenile rape.
So you say.
Let's hope that genius IQ means you know how to help yourself. We've got you on tape making a death threat.
That could be anyone's voice. I'll challenge it in court.
What about the testimony of a cop with his own grill mark? You gonna challenge that too? What happened to your face? It used to be so pretty.
I'll only give my confession to Detective Mackey.
You don't make demands, not to me.
Now, for anyone listening to you who's a fan of The Shield, they'll be able to hear that your accent as you're speaking to us now is a little different than how Claudette sounds.
Right, right.
What's the difference?
I'm from British Guiana, which is now Guyana. I grew up in England, and I came here as an adult. I spent 7 years working on American accents, and then Peggy Rogers, who was, by the way, from Philadelphia, was one of my friends in college. And I said to her, Peggy, I need to speak the way you speak. And that's how we started. And basically, for the first 3 years of my friendship with Peggy, I stole her voice and would use it for auditions and so on. And then as the years have gone by, it's sort of become that sort of mid-Atlantic in the middle accent that I do use for work, because a black British actress, when I arrived here, didn't have that much to do except go to auditions and people have you call, always have callbacks and kind of go, listen to this one talk. And I always thought that was the oddest thing. But now, you know, years have gone by and we're much more international and aware of the rest of the world.
So would you show up at the audition speaking to the casting director in your more mid-Atlantic voice so that they wouldn't be prejudiced against
Oh, absolutely.
Your British accent?
Absolutely, because unfortunately, there's a lot of things in America that sort of go with black. I mean, I've actually been told by directors, could I be more black? And I would say sort of, well, just look at me and tell me what exactly do you want, because I can't get much blacker than I physically am. But what attitude would you like? So it's forced them to describe human feelings in a much higher range than usually when I'm around. You know, it's been really fascinating, because this is a kind of sidebar, Terry. The thing about being black and having a different accent in the beginning is that it makes you foreign, and then it does not make you, how can I use this word? I'll say it, and then you edit it some other way, a nigger. And so that with your accent, you are somewhat protected always by being foreign. But I wanted to be an American actress coming from England. I knew that that was where the real stories would be. And it would take England much, much longer to come up with these stories. They're just getting their feet wet now. And this is 25 years ago. And I subjected myself to that feeling so that when people talk to you and you receive those insults and barbs, and I replied just the way with my same neck jerk and I gave them what for, and you kind of become a part of society. It's part of the whole assimilation system, really. And the moment that you're not foreign, then you get hurts and pains and pangs that you are no longer protected by your foreignness, which people, regardless of your color, always give you the opportunity of giving you graciousness, politeness. They give you the excuse of, well, they're not from here, so they really would not understand.
So,
does that make sense to you?
And I want to ask you about that in a second, but first I wanted to ask you, you used what we often call the N-word. Do you want us to use that word, or did you want us to edit it out?
I couldn't find another word. That really is
That's the word.
Mm-hmm. That's the word. I had never been called it until I got an American accent. That's really important.
That's really interesting. I think that's really, really interesting. So tell me more what you think that says about people's assumptions about African Americans and Black people from other countries.
It is with the same wonderfulness that French people treat African Americans and the disdain that they treat Africans.
Mm-hmm.
It is with the same difference that the British treat African Americans compared to how they treat West Indians, part of their colonies. And therefore, America does the same with African Americans because we African Americans here are their colonized people of who were the underbelly people, the lower strata people. So I hope that's really, really clear. I really want it to be clear.
CCH Pounder speaking with Terry Gross last year. We'll have more of their conversation in the second half of the show. I'm David B. Inculli, and this is Fresh Air.
Support for NPR comes from Barnes & Noble, publishers of the Barnes & Noble Classics edition of The Pilgrim's Progress by John Bunyan, in stores and online at bn.com. From the Pew Charitable Trusts, helping states protect public safety, hold offenders accountable, and control the cost of corrections at pewpublicsafety.org. And from the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, supporting health insurance coverage for all America's children. On the web at covertheuninsured.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, more of our interview with CCH Pounder about growing up in Guyana and about the kind of roles she used to get, playing victims and crack mothers who sell their babies. Also, David Edelstein reviews Hot Fuzz, the new parody by the makers of Shaun of the Dead. We'll be right back. This is Fresh Air. I'm David B. Incouli. We're continuing our salute to the FX series The Shield, which is now in its sixth season. Let's get back to Terry's interview with CCH Pounder, who plays Claudette Wims. This season, Claudette finally has been promoted to captain, and Detective Vic Mackey, played by Michael Chiklis, is being pressured into a forced retirement. In this scene from the season opener, Wims is giving Mackey the bad news, or trying to.
This came directly from the chief's office.
I suppose my retirement effective immediately.
Yes, you take it now and the chief will see you get a piece of your pension.
Why now? I had until my 15 mark.
Certain things are in motion. This is a lifeline. Sign this and it'll save us all a lot of grief. If you don't...
You can't cut me loose.
It's not my idea.
Brass is going to be watching every move you make. You need me to make this place work.
I need people I can trust.
So you won't help me fight this?
You know a reason I should.
Quentin showed up at another clinic. Uni spooked him. He's got hostages.
Who are you going to trust with that?
In earlier seasons of The Shield, it appeared that Claudette might be promoted to captain, but again and again she was passed over, which angered not only Wims, but many viewers as well.
I was trying to be captain for quite a while, this character, and when I didn't get it the first time and Glenn Close's character got it, I tell you, the news, the letters, the emails were amazing. I had no idea that it would have such an impact, but it went to the bottom line of American racism and how
really? Like
people
they gave it to a white actress, that kind of thing?
Absolutely. Uh-huh. Oh, I couldn't believe it. And, you know, you really forget that out in the world there, somehow it translates to a sort of a real place for many, many people. So that was about being shoved aside just like it is in the real world, and people were quite angry and very pissed off. And so they have been sending letters going, if they don't give you that job, I'm gonna, if they don't do that, and they were very clear. I'm leaving the blanks out, but right. They were very clear about how they felt.
Just for our listeners who haven't been following The Shield, Glenn Close was the guest star for a whole season. And when you were passed over for captain, she became the captain. So, right. Now, your character and your character's fans were resentful that she was passed over and Glenn Close got the job as captain. Were you, as an actress, resentful? Did you expect that your character was going to be made captain? And were you sorry that Glenn Close came in and took the position?
Oh, no, far from it. As a matter of fact, our writers must find me to be probably the most unusual actress that they've dealt with, because I think many of us want to be in a position that reflects real life, like upward mobility. They're the center of attention. And it's not necessarily my interest as an actor. My fascination is how do human beings get themselves out of this particular corner of a box. And usually they would call an actress in and say, okay, we're going to do this season. And I usually say, I don't want to know about it. Just write the script and I'll figure it out. And that's very tough for a lot of other actors to believe and or take.
Now, in addition to your regular part on The Shield, you've done a lot of the crime shows. You've done Law and Order and Cagney and Lacey and Hill Street Blues. And I mean, have you done a lot of victims and you know, perps on those shows?
In the beginning, I did. In the beginning, I was the sniveling wife with the crying baby, selling crack for medication for her children, or being accosted by her husband, abused by her husband. I spent a couple of years literally just crying on cue. And I think it was actually Miami Vice. Miami Vice, I played a mother on crack who sold her child for crack cocaine. And at the end of it, I had a marvelous time, by the way, in terms of acting. I had a great time. And at the end of it, I looked back and I went, I never want to do this again. Because I had by this time discovered how powerful television really, really is. Television is this incredibly powerful medium that people blur the lines between reality and fiction and take it as gospel. So I decided that after that, I'm going to play some women of worth, of character, of strength, of authority, educated, because the people who were watching me needed to see something that was far more uplifting than what I had been doing.
So what did you do, like sit home and wait for people to offer you uplifting roles?
I did, and I starved for about a year and a half. And I remember distinctly calling my agent and saying, okay, well, I'm really sort of 6 cents in the cookie jar now, so whatever comes next, I'm going to have to take it. And it was a script for not Law and Order, L.A. Law, the very first one, L.A. Law. And I got the entire script, and there was a miserable little person that I was meant to read for. And then there was the character of the judge, and I said, I want to read for the judge. And I was told that no black woman had read for the judge yet, and they didn't think they would let you in to do it. And I insisted, and my agents backed me up. And I went and read for the judge, and they were all like, oh, wow, I guess, yeah, she could be a judge. She could be a judge. There black judges aren't there. That was one of the quotes I heard in the room. There are black judges aren't there. I mean, that are women. And somebody said, I'll look it up. I remember a young kid. And I got that job.
Well, you know, since we were talking about different accents before and different voice placements, I'm wondering, like, in your years as a victim on TV shows, mm-hmm. on crime shows, was there a certain kind of voice that you would use for that?
Well, it was kind of always high and kind of whiny, and then I'm not quite sure where she went, but she was over there, and I had the children down. They were like down two stairs, and I just don't know where they are right now. But it was kind of like that, an endless parade of that. So you know, after a while, you got really nasally.
And why that voice? What matches about that voice with the kind of victim that you had to play?
For some reason, high and seems, I guess, in the minds of people, female, therefore vulnerable, therefore less than, you know, somebody who needs aid, come to the one's rescue. It's really true.
And now, in your role on The Shield, you use a very deep version of your voice.
Right. I like the professionalism of that. I like the fact that...
Oh, it's power, isn't it?
Yes, yes. It is a maleness that I don't have physically, but I try to ground that maleness, that boys' club, in the sound of her voice. And by doing so, she gets almost instant authority. And I'm always trying to lose weight, and they're always happy when I'm heftier. and so it's sort of that sort of hefty look with the deep voice and piercing eyes. It's like, yes, that's Claudette Wims. But, you know, it's part of human nature that we certainly recognize signage. And that really is signage.
CCH Pounder, speaking to Terry Gross last year. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to Terry's 2006 interview with CCH Pounder. She plays Claudette Wims, a longtime detective and recently promoted captain on the FX series The Shield.
No, it's interesting. You spend a lot of time in Africa, too, because your husband's from Senegal and
right.
runs a museum there. So you're in Senegal a good deal of the time. So mm-hmm. you're also a black person in Africa. And right. how does, what are the, some of the assumptions you've run into there?
Well, in Africa, I would be called a Tubab, which means white for some people, but really it means foreign. And so it's the same. I'm very well treated in Africa because there is the assumption that I'm also exceedingly rich. And I have the status. The first foreigners that came were white, maybe Portuguese, and they had the, you know, the white people were the Tubabs. So I've heard them call me, you know, no, not that lady, the Tubab lady. And they know exactly who I would be.
And do they think that you're rich because you're foreign or because you work on television?
Well, they haven't seen me. Oh, yes, they have seen me on television now. But in the beginning, no, because you're from outside. It just really means, you know, coming from another place.
Now, does being an actress and a successful one and being on a series like The Shield get you a ticket out of all of those assumptions about how race or country define you?
Oh, yeah, sometimes, because that makes you different. You know, you're more iconic. So it can be, you can be in the presence of, say white people. You're in the presence of white people. They're talking about black people negatively. They see you, but they don't mean you. You're different. So you become iconic. And that's very common. I know many, many people are very aware of that.
So have you used different versions of your accent and different versions of American regional accents in your roles in television, knowing some of the implications that accents have in terms of the assumptions people make about others?
All the time. And everyone does it all the time. It's just the difference between, like, you can speak in scatologically around amongst your friends and they understand what you mean.
Mm-hmm.
You speak better towards your parents. You speak in a very formal way towards people that you've never met before. And so imagine, Terry, that I am from a very interracial family in terms of where we grew up. So I was born in Guyana, which has a kind of accent like that. And everybody speaks a little bit on the high side. And good morning, girl. It's so nice to see you. That's where I started. And then you ended up in England. So you have, I did speak the Queen's English and it was in a boarding school. So it's very, very proper. And then you got to America, but you didn't land in, say, Maryland. You landed in Brooklyn. So I've got an edge as well. So while I'm speaking at my dinner table, you could hear all of those accents all within one conversation. It just sounds like the Tower of Babel, but we all seem to manage and get along.
Now, you grew up in British Guiana, and I know you must be asked all the time the question I'm mm-hmm. about to ask you, which is, did you know anybody who was involved in any way with Jim Jones' cult group in Jonestown? Now, that might have been French Guiana and not British Guiana?
No, it was in British Guiana.
It was in British Guiana?
Yeah, it was in British Guiana. And no, I didn't know. And in fact, not many Guyanese people knew about Jim Jones until after the fact, until the airport incident, until it was literally all over, because the people were from the United States. And I don't know if you know the back history. This was when Guyana was opening up its land for development and was offering land, you know, from peoples from all over the world to come there and develop the land. And they would get sort of 70% and the government would get 30%. So Jim Jones's group were the first Americans that came and created that extraordinary tragedy. And very few Guyanese people know about them because they were in the interior. And as you may or may not know, Guyana is mostly occupied right at the water's edge in Georgetown. That's the majority of the people. We don't even have 1 million people in Guyana. It's a small, mm-hmm. small population and a really primordial kind of country. It's the real deal jungle. It's the orchids hanging from the branches. It's anaconda and all manner of strange-looking creatures and bright yellow frogs and just an exquisite place. but that kind of raw, scary beauty that you expect King Kong to come swinging around the corner. And so people have hugged mostly to the edges, which is Georgetown, the biggest, the capital and the biggest city, and that's right on the coast. And there are a few interior towns, New Amsterdam and Bartica, but where Jim Jones was, not a lot of people knew them.
So how much contact did you have with the jungle?
As I was growing up as a kid, none whatsoever, because I was on a sugarcane estate or plantation, and that was a clear jungle. This was miles and miles of sugarcane and canals, lots of water everywhere.
Did your family own the plantation or work on the plantation?
My father was the first African to, he was the second in command at Versailles Estate.
Now, I also read that your parents didn't really want you to be an actress. They didn't have a lot of respect for the profession.
Right. My parents are sort of staunch West Indians. They love a work ethic. They believe in doctors, lawyers, something concrete, something that does something for the world. And acting was sort of like, you know, closer to the first oldest profession as far as they were concerned. They thought this was a waste of an education and somewhat sleazy.
And obviously you disagreed.
Putting it nicely. I did disagree, but I'm telling you, it took me a very, very long time to say out loud, I am an actress, and I'm an actor. It took me a long time. If I was working as a secretary, I'd be proud to say I'm a secretary. You know, I'm working at an insurance company, and I did tons of temporary jobs, as all actors do. And even when I went to college, I did not go directly to the drama department. I went to the French and English department and thought I would major in English and then minor in drama. And it took a while to say out loud, I'm an actor. And then I had to do it. And I was running out of time and excuses.
You know what I think is funny? Like, your parents are thinking, It's a sleazy profession. It's not respectable. And you think, no, it's a fine profession. And then you end up having to play women who are selling their babies for crack.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. But I'm proud to be able to say now that every profession that my mother ever wanted me to do, I've done it in acting.
I have one more question for you. Remember earlier we were talking about how being from Guyana, you had, you know, a British accent, and wherever you went in the world, people would evaluate you based on your accent. And in America,
right,
people would treat you probably better than they treat African Americans because you were an outsider. Mm-hmm. And everybody has the people who they've kind of like colonialized and they look down on. What was it like growing up black in Guyana?
Well, we were the big cheese there. That was never knowing what racism's about. In Guyana, it's all about poverty. It's about haves and have-nots, and that's very, very different. It's not about the color of your skin, because everybody's skin is black. The Indians, they're East Indians. They're the majority of the population. They're black also. The whites are so burnt and crispified, they look like black people there too. So they're... It's a sort of, everybody is basically brown in Guyana, and the differences, and there are many cultural differences. There's East Indian, there's Hindu, there's Muslim, there's Christian. There is a native Indian. So there's all of that mix, but poverty is a great equalizer. And so that there are more people equal there than they're non-equal. And it's really about the haves and the have-nots. And in Guyana, I was a have.
CCH Pounder, speaking to Terry Gross in 2006. She plays Captain Claudette Wims in The Shield, now in its sixth season on the FX cable network. Coming up, film critic David Edelstein reviews Hot Fuzz. This is Fresh Air. Director Edgar Wright and actor and writer Simon Pegg came to prominence in England for their TV sitcom Spaced. Together, they wrote the zombie comedy of manners Shaun of the Dead, starring Pegg and directed by Wright. Their new film, Hot Fuzz, is set in a bucolic English village where things just aren't the way they seem. Film critic David Edelstein has a review.
The English have a wellspring of humor that can never be exhausted. It's the combination of bestial urges and good manners. The Ealing black comedies with Alec Guinness dramatized the schism lovingly. The Monty Python lads devised more raucous sketches, implying the problem was mental defectiveness born of inbreeding. And in movies like Monty Python and the Holy Grail, they blended English deadpan with the lopping off of limbs. In 2004, the team of Edgar Wright and actor Simon Pegg took the lunatic disjunction to the next level. In Shaun of the Dead, they fused middle-class English suburban angst and zombie carnage. Some critics dubbed the film a spoof of horror movies, which didn't do it justice. Wright and Pegg aimed higher, using zombies to spoof the English capacity for blotting out the bloody obvious. I especially relish the hero's meek mother, who neglects to tell her son about her bite from a contagious ghoul until she's about to transform into a ferocious zombie cannibal. She says, "I didn't want to be a bother." Now Wright and Pegg have collaborated on Hot Fuzz, which is nearly as good as Shaun of the Dead and is probably more accessible to people who don't, like me, see every zombie cannibal flick as a matter of course. Here the joke is that a quaint old English hamlet with a clucking flower shop lady, a hearty vicar, and all sorts of elderly busybodies is the setting for a splattery, over-the-top, over-budgeted Hollywood buddy action picture. The hero, once again played by Simon Pegg, is Angel, a humorless, by-the-book city cop who's bounced out of London for making too many arrests and making the rest of the force look bad. He ends up in tiny Sanford, a finalist for the title of England's most picturesque village, where he's forced to sit with the pudgy constable, Danny Butterman, played by Pegg's frequent collaborator, Nick Frost, clocking passing automobiles and waiting for speeders.
27.
Have you ever seen Point Break?
No.
Amazing bit in Point Break where they jump over fences.
Is there none? 29.
Patrick Swayze's just robbed this bank. Keanu Reeves is chasing him through people's gardens. And he goes to shoot Swayze, but he can't because he loves him so much. And he's firing his gun up in the air. He's like, ah!
Oh. 30.
Have you ever fired your gun up in the air and gone, ah?
No, I have not ever fired my gun up in the air and gone, ah.
30. Sorry, I just feel like I'm missing out sometimes. I want to do what you do.
You do what I do. What on earth do you think you're missing out on?
Gunfights, car chases, proper action.
Police work is not about proper action.
29. If you'd have paid attention to me in school, you'd understand that it's not all about gunfights and car chases. Fire up the roof.
That was brilliant.
It's rather sweet how Danny dreams of being like Keanu Reeves in Point Break, yet seems blind to the conspiracy breaking under his nose, manifest in a series of really gross beheadings, squashings, and impalings that his doddering police chief dad, played by Jim Broadbent, shrugs off as accidents. But Angel, he doesn't buy the accident theory. No, something about this town is too pretty, too polite, too orderly. Hot Fuzz is great fun, and it's nice to see all the old English character actors who aren't busy in Harry Potter films, like Broadbent, Billy Whitelaw, Anne Reed, and Edward Woodward. One time James Bond Timothy Dalton is splendidly unctuous as a local grocery store magnate, and there are lots of surprise cameos. Better than that, it's not just a string of gags. If Shaun of the Dead was at heart the archetypal story of a child man who finally has the courage to grow up, to take responsibility for his life, commit to a woman, and make peace at last with his mother, whose head he also has to blow off with a shotgun, Hot Fuzz is a story of small-town English repression and the tradition of heroic American individualism that lays waste to it. The climax is everything you could hope for. As in Shaun of the Dead, the mayhem is shockingly graphic, which helps to keep the slapstick from getting too campy comfy. It lampoons the ultimate overblown Jerry Bruckheimer artillery picture, Bad Boys 2, while still delivering the goods, a brilliantly edited battle in which Tweety pensioners wield massive artillery and the whole town explodes. Well, not the actual town in point of fact, but a small, scaled-down developer's model of the town, the kind where the buildings come up to your waist. That's the beauty of Wright and Pegg's aesthetic. The scale of their enterprises is funhouse absurd. But you recognize the terrain. As the New Yorker used to put it, there'll always be an England.
David Edelstein is film critic for New York Magazine. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Bob Purdick. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Sharrock directs the show. WHYY's executive producer of national radio programming is Elizabeth Perez Luna. Our theme music was composed by Joel Forrester and performed by the Microscopic Septet. For Terry Gross, I'm David Bean Cooley.
Support for NPR comes from Delacorte Press, publisher of Evolution for Everyone, How Darwin's Theory Can Change the Way We Think About Our Lives, by David Sloan Wilson. From Bonterra Vineyards, Mendocino, California, fine wines made with organically grown grapes and respect for the earth. Bonterra promotes responsible drinking. And from Miramax Home Entertainment, presenting The Queen, starring Helen Mirren, available on DVD April 24th. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Bill Moyers has returned to PBS with new editions of Bill Moyers' Journal. The first episode is about the role of the press in the lead-up to the Iraq War. On the next Fresh Air, we talk with Bill Moyers. Join us for the next Fresh Air.